Hey, hope everyone is enjoying their weekend. We've had so many interesting conversations and insights into the cases we're following for you this week. Wanted to play back some of the ones I found most compelling in the last 7 days. Here's one of them in our Week in Review.
This is a podcast that seeks justice. Justice for the lives stolen by those in society that hide amongst us every day. Hidden in our towns, cities, and countrysides, the places that we work, and sometimes in our very own homes. This is Hidden Killers.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Tony Bruschi. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any of our breaking updates and discussions on the cases that we are following for you. In this segment, we're going to be talking about the Brian Koberger case with former FBI Special Agent Jennifer Coffendaffer. Jennifer, you have been following this extensively all the way from the beginning. I'm curious as to get your thoughts on the information that has come out, not officially, but from very good sources, about the firing of Brian Koberger and all of the disciplinary actions that were taken against him when he was a TA at Pullman. The timing of the occurrences of the murders and some of the actions, coincidence or not, considering the murders took place within 24 hours of one of those come-to-Jesus meetings that took place at Pullman.
Well, I will say this. I am still looking at this as an allegation because it has not been confirmed by WSU. Mm-hmm. It hasn't been confirmed by law enforcement. So while we have very strong reporting and reporting that the sources are very credible, there's also information that is sort of the antithesis of it being able to be believed. If you're to look at certain information out there from the social media realm that isn't near as reliable as a mainstream media individual coming forth with the information. So I'm going to caveat my comment that it's an allegation, mm-hmm. that we don't have the definite proof of this yet. But if we are to believe this is true, it's very interesting, and I think it would have possibly ignited him. Just imagine how he's feeling now. He's looking at losing his job. He's looking at losing a source of income. He's looking at his PhD possibly being called into somewhat jeopardy because of this situation, embarrassment. He's already, I believe, if indeed he committed these crimes, you know, feeling inadequate, feeling angered, feeling hostility. And I believe this could have just been the push he needed to make the decision as all of this was unraveling before him.
Was it like a trigger is what I'm wondering? And how much of a plot did he have to kill these women as much as it was stalking and this sort of fantasy? Was it a perfect storm of being rejected in the profession that he was so passionate about, and then at the same time, this underlying resentment for women and this stalking behavior that he was doing, seeing as the basement victims weren't touched at all, was this just that, the perfect storm, the rejection professionally, and he already had this in the back of his mind? Was it, well, tonight's the night I'm going to carry this out kind of on a whim?
Well, I wouldn't call it a whim. I agree with everything you said, that the stalking, the 12 times there, the identification of the house, the identification of the victims, all of this was planned. However, what was the trigger that just pushed him over to the timing piece of it? I think this crime would have been committed by him at some point, mm-hmm. no matter what, because of what was festering up inside of him. So it would seem by the facts we have to date, but the timing that was chosen, November 13th, I think that could have been pushed if indeed these allegations are proved to be true, that he was under severe scrutiny. I think that that was the trigger.
I'm curious to get your thoughts on this, and I want to first phrase this. This is in no way questioning the legitimacy of the stories of the roommates who were downstairs, but it seems to be that there has been some discrepancies, and I don't know if this means absolutely nothing at all. I know there's some reporting on Banfield on News Nation that the roommate mistook the noises that she was hearing, yelled to her roommate to quiet down, thinking it was her roommate still being loud. Within minutes, more noise, opens the door, and that's when she sees who she thought was Koberger coming towards her. Didn't think anything other than it was a friend or someone else, closed the door, locked it, and went to bed. The difference in what is said in the PCA and this speak to the importance of different statements of what occurred. Is this just recollections and just people making statements with slight discrepancies, or is there more to that?
Well, first of all, the bedrock of this case that's in the public right now is that PCA. This is a sworn to document. This is my go-to in terms of facts as we know them.
Yeah.
Compare that to source information. Compare that to the fact we know DM opened the door, at least opened the door three times. Mm-hmm. Exactly whether they stepped outside the threshold or not, we don't exactly know, but certainly opened the door and inquired. And I could see it being sort of a mischaracterization, the telephone game of exactly when that was said. Tony, these interviews, and I think there would have been more than one of DM, would have been long, would have been exhaustive, would involve being recorded, hopefully, and a long tape recording that is going to be used in court. In addition, there's going to be the written reports and documents of what she said. So this is something that she just didn't say what was in the PCA. This is going to be like a novel. Mm-hmm. Of her recollection of everything. So I can see, in my opinion, that it's extrapolated, if you will. Mm-hmm. And she probably did initially. She even talks about Kaylee playing with the dog in the affidavit. You know, come on, guys, be quiet. I'm trying to go to bed. And I think that was probably true. But that had to do with the first time she came to the door, not the last. Mm-hmm. I think that last time she came to the doorway, I believe that PCA, I think she was frightened. I think she saw this man at 4 a.m. clad in black and shut that door and, you know, never reopened it and thankfully locked it.
I know one of your favorite rabbit holes watching you on Twitter is Papa Roger. and you're always finding new things about it. And I'm always fascinated by what you're finding. And it's creepy. Because it's the same amount of detail that whoever Papa Roger is, and if it's Koberger, it all lines up. I mean, if it's a conspiracy theory, it's coming true. What are some of the details that you've discovered in the last couple of weeks that have been standing out to you when you go down that rabbit hole?
Well, when I'm running down that rabbit hole, a couple of details have come to light. One specifically was a political post. Where he finds himself upset that a particular political candidate in California apparently says something derogatory toward our military. And so he has a very short and curt post about that. And then he also has a post about a budget, a school budget, if you will, in Indiana. And I've really been digging on that. In fact, I've been calling people mm-hmm. on that were part of that string. And the randomness, if you will, between the obsessive posts that are done on the Idaho 4 murders, mm-hmm. that are post after post after post, then you have these two oddballs that are not related. So now you have three random posting or post, at least areas of posting. Mm-hmm. That randomness I find very interesting. And I'm still, Tony, I'm still down that rabbit hill. So I'm researching if there are any connections in the California district, any connections in that school district. And I hope to have some answers soon.
Very interesting. I'm going to keep following that, and I'm sure we'll talk about that the next time we talk and what you found. The Gonzalez family not happy about the non-disclosure and the gag order. I know they want to be able to talk, and quite literally right before we came on the air here. The prosecution in the Koberger case filed a motion to keep the gag order in place. They're responding to victim Kaylee Gonzalez's lawyer asking the judge to allow them to speak. Prosecutors arguing the attorney has special access to info through his clients and the gag order should apply. That just coming out from Brian Enten. I don't know if you've seen that new filing yet in the last few moments. Thoughts on the back and forth on this? Should that gag order stay the way it is, or does the Gonzalez family have a right to be able to speak more?
Well, when this initially, when the motion first came out, I believed that there was no way this motion would be granted. Mm-hmm. I believed it would be denied by the judge. And I believe the prosecution would move toward that. And we're sort of seeing this play out now with the prosecution saying why and filing, you know, their juxtaposition. I believe the gag order needs to stay in place. Look at where we're at with the gag order in place. Sure. Social media running wild, accusations running wild. It's unbelievable how much quote unquote information is out there that is being put out there in social media realms that really, in a lot of instances, has absolutely no factual backing. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, goes against what the PCA says. So I think a gag order is very important for the sanctity of this case. If justice is what is being sought here, they need to keep a lid on this investigation or on their investigative findings and on these facts, Tony. I really believe that.
Jennifer Coffendaffer, former FBI agent, thank you so much for your insight into this case. Always very much appreciated. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. You don't miss any of our breaking updates and discussions on the cases that we are following for you right here. My name is Tony Bruschi. You can follow me on Twitter @TonyBPod. Until next time, for all of us, thanks for listening.